the 3-foot sword I carry. But not so long as I feel there is a distinction between nature and humankind. Not so long as I remain distant from the realm of the true expert, the fully developed man. His contemplation was interrupted by the chattering of some merchants who had climbed up near where he was and were gazing at the peak.
They were right! You can see it!
But it's not often you can bow before the sacred mountain from here. Travelers moved in ant-like streams in both directions, laden with a kaleidoscopic array of luggage. Sooner or later, Daizo and Jotaro would come up the hill. If by chance he failed to pick them out from among the other travelers, surely they would see the sign he had left at the foot of the cliff. To Daizo of Narai, I wish to see you when you pass through. I shall wait at the shrine up above. Musashi, Jotaro's teacher. The sun was well above the horizon now. Musashi had been watching the road like a hawk, but there was no sign of Daizo. On the other side of the pass, the road divided into three. One went through Koshu straight to Edo. Another, the main route, crossed Usui Pass and entered Edo from the north. The third veered off to the northern provinces. Whether Daizo was going north to the Zenkoji or east to Edo, he would have to use this pass. Still, as Musashi realized, people did not always move as one might expect. The wholesaler could have gone somewhere well off the beaten path, or he could be spending an extra night at the foot of the mountain. Musashi decided it might not be a bad idea to go back there and ask about Daizo. As he started down the path cut into the cliffside, he heard a familiar raucous voice say, "There he is, up there!" It brought to mind instantly the staff that had grazed his body 2 nights before.
"Come down from there!"
Gonnosuke shouted. Staff in hand, he glared at Musashi.
"You ran away! You figured I'd challenge you and ducked out. Come down, fight me one more time!"
Musashi stopped between two rocks, leaned against one of them, and stared silently at Gonnosuke. Taking this to mean that he was not coming, Gonnosuke said to his mother,
"Wait here! I'll go up there and throw him down. Just watch!"
"Stop!"
scolded his mother, who was astride the cow.
"That's what's wrong with you. You're impatient. You have to learn to read your enemy's thoughts before you go flying into battle. Supposing he were to throw a big rock down on you, then what?"
Musashi could hear their voices, but the words were not clear. As far as he was concerned, he'd already won. He already understood how Gonnosuke used his staff. What he found upsetting was their bitterness and their desire for revenge. If Gonnosuke lost again, they would be that much more resentful. From his experience with the House of Yoshioka, he knew the folly of fighting bouts that led to even greater hostility. And then there was the man's mother, in whom Musashi saw a second Osugi, a woman who loved her son blindly and would bear an eternal grudge against anyone who harmed him. He turned around and began climbing.
"Wait!"
Held back by the strength of the old woman's voice, Musashi stopped and turned around. She dismounted and walked to the foot of the cliff. When she was sure she had his attention, she knelt, put both hands on the ground, and bowed deeply. Musashi had done nothing to cause her to humble herself before him, but he bowed back as best he could from the rocky path. His hand went out as though to help her up.
"Good samurai," she cried. "I am ashamed to appear before you like this. I'm sure you have nothing but scorn for my stubbornness. But I'm not acting out of hate or spite or ill will. I ask you to take pity on my son. For 10 years, he's practiced all by himself. No teachers, no friends, no truly worthy opponents. I beg you to give him another lesson in the art of fighting."
Musashi listened silently.
"I would hate to see you part from us like this," she continued emotionally. "My son's performance 2 days ago was shoddy,
If he doesn't do something to prove his ability, neither he nor I will be able to face our ancestors. Right now, he's nothing more than a farmer who lost a fight. Since he's had the good fortune to meet a warrior of your stature, it would be a shame for him not to profit from the experience. That's why I've brought him here. I implore you to heed my pleas and accept his challenge.
Her speech ended, she bowed again, almost as though she were worshipping at Musashi's feet. Coming down the hill, he took her hand and helped her back up onto the cow.
Gonnosuke, he said, take the rope.
Let's talk this over while we walk. I'll consider whether I want to fight you or not.
Musashi walked slightly ahead of them, and though he had suggested discussing the question, said not a word.
Gonnosuke kept his eyes suspiciously on Musashi's back, now and again absently flicking a switch at the cow's legs. His mother looked anxious and worried. When they had gone perhaps a mile, Musashi grunted and turned on his heel.
I'll fight you, he said.
Dropping the rope, Gonnosuke said,
Are you ready now?
He looked around to check his position, as if ready to have it out right then and there. Ignoring him, Musashi addressed his mother.
Are you prepared for the worst? There's not a whit's difference between a bout like this and a fight to the death, even if the weapons are not the same.
For the first time, the old woman laughed.
No need to tell me that. If he loses to a younger man like you, then he may as well give up the martial arts. And if he does that, there'd be no further point in living. If it turns out that way, I'll bear you no grudge.
If that's the way you feel, all right.
He picked up the rope Gonnosuke had thrown down.
If we stay on the road, there'll be people in the way. Let's tie the cow up, then I'll fight as long as you wish.
There was a huge larch tree in the very middle of the flat area on which they stood. Pointing at it, Musashi led them there.
Make your preparations, Gonnosuke, he said calmly.
Gonnosuke needed no urging. In a moment, he was standing before Musashi with his staff pointed toward the ground. Musashi stood empty-handed, arms and shoulders relaxed.
Aren't you going to make any preparations? Asked Gonnosuke.
What for?
Gonnosuke's anger flared.
Get something to fight with! Anything you want!
I'm ready.
No weapon?
I have my weapon here, Musashi replied, bringing his left hand up to his sword hilt.
You're fighting with a sword?
Musashi's only reply was a crooked little smile at the corner of his mouth. They were already at the stage where he couldn't afford to waste breath talking. Underneath the larch tree sat Gonnosuke's mother, looking like a stone Buddha.
Don't fight yet. Wait, she said.
Staring at each other, not making the slightest move, neither man seemed to hear. Gonnosuke's staff was waiting under his arm for the opportunity to strike, as if it had breathed in all the air on the plateau and was about to exhale it in one great screeching blow. His hand glued to the underside of his sword hilt, Musashi's eyes seemed to pierce Gonnosuke's body. Inwardly, the battle had already begun, for the eye can damage a man more seriously than a sword or staff. After the opening slice is made with the eye, the sword or staff slips in effortlessly.
Wait!
Called the mother again.
What is it?
Asked Musashi, jumping back 4 or 5 feet to a safe position.
You're fighting with a real sword?
The way I fight, it doesn't make any difference whether I use a wooden sword or a real one.
I'm not trying to stop you.
I want to be sure you understand. The sword, wood or steel, is absolute. In a real bout, there are no halfway measures. The only way to avoid risk is to run away.
You're perfectly right, but it occurred to me that in a match this important, you should announce yourself formally. Each of you is meeting an opponent the likes of whom he will encounter only rarely. After the fight's over, it'll be too late.
True.
Gonnosuke. Give your name first.
Gonosuke bowed formally to Musashi.
Our distant ancestor is said to have been Kakumyo, who fought under the banner of the great warrior of Kiso, Minamoto no Yoshinaka. After Yoshinaka's death, Kakumyo became a follower of the saint Honen, and it is possible that we are from the same family as he. Over the centuries, our ancestors have lived in this area, but in my father's generation, we suffered dishonor, which I shall not name. In my distress, I went with my mother to Ontake Shrine and vowed in writing that I would restore our good name by following the way of the samurai. Before the god of Ontake Shrine, I acquired my technique for using the staff. I call it the Musou style, that is, the style of the vision, for I received it in a revelation at the shrine. People call me Musou Gonnosuke.
Musashi returned his bow.
My family is descended from Hirata Shogen, whose house was a branch of the Akamatsus of Harima. I am the only son of Shinmen Munisai, who lived in the village of Miyamoto in Mimasaka. I have been given the name Miyamoto Musashi. I have no close relatives, and I have dedicated my life to the way of the sword. If I should fall before your staff, there is no need to trouble yourself about my remains. Retaking his stance, he cried, "On guard! On guard!"
The old woman seemed scarcely to breathe. Far from having danger thrust on herself and her son, she had gone out of her way to seek it out, deliberately placing her son in front of Musashi's gleaming sword. Such a course would have been unthinkable for an ordinary mother, but she was fully confident she had done the right thing. She sat now in formal style, her shoulders leaning slightly forward, and her hands placed primly, one on top of the other, on her knees. Her body gave the impression of being small and shrunken. It would have been hard to believe that she had borne several children, buried all but one of them, and persevered through innumerable hardships to make a warrior out of the lone survivor. Her eyes emitted a flash of light, as though all the gods and bodhisattvas of the cosmos had gathered in her person to witness the battle. In the instant when Musashi unsheathed, Gonnosuke felt a chill go through his body. He sensed instinctively that his fate, exposed to Musashi's sword, had already been decided, for at this moment he saw before him a man he had not seen before. 2 days earlier, he had observed Musashi in a fluid, flexible mood, one that might be likened to smooth, flowing lines of calligraphy in the cursive style. He was unprepared for the man who faced him now, a study in austerity, like a square, immaculately written character with every line and dot in place. Realizing that he had misjudged his adversary, he found himself unable to swing into a violent attack, as he had done before. His staff remained poised but powerless above his head. While the two men confronted each other silently, the last of the morning mist cleared away. A bird flew indolently between them and the hazy mountains in the distance. Then all at once a shriek split the air, as though the bird had plummeted to earth. It was impossible to tell whether the sound came from the sword or the staff. It was unreal, the clapping of one hand that followers of Zen talk about. Simultaneously, the two fighters' bodies, moving in perfect coordination with their weapons, shifted positions. The change took less time than it takes for an image to be transmitted from the eye to the brain. Gonnosuke's strike had missed. Musashi had defensively reversed his forearm and swept upward from near Gonnosuke's side to a point above his head, narrowly missing his right shoulder and temple. Musashi then employed his masterful return strike, the one that had previously brought all opponents to grief. But Gonnosuke, seizing his staff near the ends with both hands, blocked the sword above his own head. Had the sword not met the wood obliquely, Gonnosuke's weapon would doubtless have been split in two. In shifting, he had thrust his left elbow forward and lifted his right elbow, with the intent of striking Musashi in the solar plexus. But at what should have been the moment of impact, the end of the staff was still a fraction of an inch from Musashi's body. With sword and staff crossed above Gonnosuke's head, neither could advance or retreat. Both knew that a false move meant sudden death. Though the position was analogous to a sword guard to sword guard impasse, Musashi was aware of the important differences between sword and staff. A staff, ostensibly, had no guard, no blade, no hilt, no point. But in the hands of an expert like Gonnosuke, any part of the four-foot weapon could be blade, point, or hilt. Thus the staff was far more versatile than the sword, and could even be used as a short lance. Unable to predict Gonnosuke's reaction, Musashi could not withdraw his weapon. Gonnosuke, on the other hand, was in an even more perilous position. His weapon was playing the passive role of blocking Musashi's blade. If he allowed his spirit to waver for so much as an instant, the sword would split open his head. Gonnosuke's face paled, he bit his lower lip, and oily sweat glistened around the upturned corners of his eyes. As the crossed weapons began to waver, his breathing became heavier.
"Gonnosuke!"
cried his mother, her face more pallid than her son's. She raised her torso and slapped her hip.
"Your hip's too high!"
she shouted, then fell forward. Her senses seemed to have left her. Her voice had sounded as though she were spitting blood. It had appeared that sword and staff would remain locked until the fighters turned to stone. At the sound of the old woman's cry, they came apart with a force more frightening than that of their coming together. Musashi, slamming his heels into the ground, leaped backward a full 7 feet. The interval was spanned in a flash by Gonnosuke and the length of his staff. Musashi barely managed to jump aside. Thwarted in this do-or-die attack, Gonnosuke stumbled forward off balance, exposing his back. Musashi moved with the speed of a peregrine falcon, and a thin flash of light connected with the dorsal muscles of his adversary, who, with the bleat of a terrified calf, stumbled and fell face down on the ground. Musashi sat down with a thud on the grass, holding his hand to his stomach. "I give up!" he shouted. No sound came from Gonnosuke. His mother, too stunned to speak, stared blankly at his prostrate form. "I use the ridge of the sword," said Musashi, turning to her. Since she did not seem to comprehend, he said, "Get him some water. He's not badly hurt."
"What?"
she cried in disbelief. Seeing there was no blood on her son's body, she staggered to his side and threw her arms around him. She called his name, brought him water, then shook him until he came to his senses. Gonnosuke gazed vacantly at Musashi for a few minutes, then walked over to him and bowed his forehead to the ground.
"I'm sorry," he said simply. "You're too good for me."
Musashi, seemingly awakened from a trance, grasped his hand and said,
"Why do you say that? You didn't lose. I did."
He opened the front of his kimono.
"Look at this."
He pointed to a red spot where the staff had struck him.
"Only a little more, and I'd have been killed."
There was a tremor of shock in his voice, for the truth was, he had not yet figured out when or how he had suffered the wound. Gonnosuke and his mother stared at the red mark but said nothing. Pulling his kimono together, Musashi asked the old woman why she had cautioned her son about his hips. Had she observed something faulty or dangerous in his stance?
"Well, I'm no expert in these matters, but as I watched him using all his strength to hold your sword off, it seemed to me he was missing an opportunity. He couldn't advance, couldn't retreat, and he was too excited. But I saw that if he simply dropped his hips, holding his hands the way they were, the end of the staff would naturally strike your chest. It all happened in an instant. At the time, I wasn't really conscious of what I said."
Musashi nodded, regarding himself fortunate to have received a useful lesson without having had to pay with his life. Gonnosuke, too, listened reverently. No doubt he had also gained a new insight. What he had just experienced was no ephemeral revelation, but a journey to the boundary between life and death. His mother, perceiving him to be on the brink of disaster, had taught him a lesson in survival. Years later, after Gonnosuke had established his own style and become known far and wide, he recorded the technique his mother had discovered on this occasion. Though he wrote at some length of his mother's devotion and of his match with Musashi, he refrained from saying that he had won. On the contrary, for the rest of his life he told people that he had lost, and that the defeat had been an invaluable lesson to him. Musashi, having wished mother and son well, proceeded on from Inojigahara to Kamisuwa, unaware that he was being followed by a samurai who inquired of all the grooms at the horse stations, as well as of other travelers, whether they had seen Musashi on the road. A One-Night Love Affair. Musashi's injury was painful, so instead of spending time in Kamisuwa to make inquiries about Otsu and Jotaro, he went on to the hot springs at Shimosuwa. This town, on the banks of Lake Suwa, was quite a large one, with the houses of ordinary townsmen alone numbering over 1,000. At the inn designated for use by daimyo, the bath was covered by a roof, but otherwise the pools situated along the roadside were open to the sky and available to anyone who wanted to use them. Musashi hung his clothes and swords on a tree and eased himself into the steaming water. As he massaged the swelling on the right side of his abdomen, he rested his head against a rock on the edge of the pool, closed his eyes, and savored a groggy, pleasurable sense of well-being. The sun was beginning to set, and a reddish mist rose from the surface of the lake, which he could see between the fishermen's houses along the shore. A couple of small vegetable plots lay between the pool and the road, where people and horses were coming and going with the usual noise and bustle. At a shop selling lamp oil and sundries, a samurai was purchasing straw sandals. Having selected a suitable pair, he sat down on a stool, took off his old ones, and tied the new ones on.
"You must have heard about it," he said to the shopkeeper. "It happened under the great spreading pine at Ichijoji near Kyoto. This ronin took on the entire house of Yoshioka all by himself and fought with a spirit you rarely hear about anymore. I'm sure he passed this way. Are you certain you didn't see him?"
For all his eagerness, the samurai seemed to know little about the man he was looking for, neither his age nor how he might be dressed. Disappointed when he received a negative reply, he repeated,
"I must find him somehow,"
2 or 3 times while he finished tying his sandals. The samurai, a man of about 40, was well-dressed and sunburned from traveling. The hair at his temples stood out around the cords of his basket hat, and the toughness in his facial expression matched his manly build. Musashi suspected his body bore the marks and calluses that come from wearing armor.
"I don't remember ever seeing him before," he thought. "But if he's going around talking about the Yoshioka school, maybe he's one of their students. The schools had so many students. A few must have some backbone. They may be hatching another plot for revenge."
When the man had completed his business and left, Musashi dried himself and put on his clothes, thinking the coast was clear. But when he walked out onto the high road, he almost bumped into him.
The samurai bowed and, looking intently into his face, said, "Aren't you Miyamoto Musashi?"
Musashi nodded, and the samurai, ignoring the suspicion written on his face, said,
"I knew it!"
After a short paean to his own perspicacity, he continued familiarly,
"You can't know how happy I am to meet you at last. I've had the feeling I'd run into you somewhere along the way."
Without pausing to give Musashi a chance to speak, he urged him to spend the night at the same inn with him.
"Let me assure you," he added, "you don't have to worry about me. My status, if you'll forgive me for saying so, is such that I usually travel with 12 attendants and a change of horses. I'm a retainer of Date Masamune, the lord of Aoba Castle in Mutsu. My name is Ishimoda Geki.
When Musashi passively accepted the invitation, Geki decided they would stay at the inn for Daimyo and led him into the place.
How about a bath? He asked. But of course, you've just had one. Well, make yourself comfortable while I take one. I'll be back shortly.
He took off his traveling clothes, picked up a towel, and left the room. Though the man had a winning way about him, Musashi's head was full of questions. Why would this well-placed warrior be looking for him? Why was he being so friendly?
Wouldn't you like to change into something more comfortable? Asked the maid, proffering one of the cotton-stuffed kimonos furnished to guests.
No, thank you. I'm not sure I'll be staying.
Musashi stepped out onto the veranda. Behind him, he heard the maid quietly setting the dinner trays. As he watched the ripples on the lake change from deep indigo to black, the image of Otsu's sad eyes formed in his mind.
I suppose I'm not looking in the right place, he thought. Anyone evil enough to kidnap a woman certainly has the instinct to avoid towns. He seemed to hear Otsu calling for help. Was it really all right to take the philosophic view that all things happen as a result of heaven's will? Standing there doing nothing, he felt guilty.
Coming back from his bath, Ishimoda Geki apologized for having left him alone and sat down before his dinner tray. Noticing that Musashi still wore his own kimono, he asked,
"Why don't you change?"
"I'm comfortable in what I have on. I wear this all the time, on the road, inside the house, when I sleep on the ground under the trees." Geki was favorably impressed.
"I might have known," he said. "You want to be ready for action at any time, no matter where you are. Lord Date would admire that."
He stared with unconcealed fascination at Musashi's face, which was lit from the side by the lamp. Remembering himself after a moment, he said,
"Come, sit down and have some sake."
He rinsed off a cup in a bowl of water and offered it to Musashi. Musashi seated himself and bowed. Resting his hands on his knees, he asked,
"Could you tell me, sir, why you're treating me in such a friendly manner? And if you don't mind, why you were inquiring about me out on the high road?" "I suppose it's only natural for you to wonder, but there's really very little to explain. Perhaps the simplest way to put it is that I have a sort of crush on you."
He paused for a moment, laughed, and went on.
"Yes, it's a matter of infatuation, a case of one man being attracted to another."
Geki seemed to feel this was sufficient explanation, but Musashi was more mystified than ever. While it did not seem impossible for one man to be enamored of another, he himself had never experienced such an attachment. Takuan was too severe to inspire strong affection. Koetsu lived in an entirely different world. Sekishusai occupied a plane so far above Musashi's that either liking or disliking was inconceivable. Though it could be Geki's way of flattering him, a man who made such statements opened himself to the charge of insincerity. Still, Musashi doubted that this samurai was a sycophant. He was too solid, too manly in appearance for that.
"Precisely what do you mean," Musashi asked with a sober air, "when you say you are attracted to me?" "Perhaps I'm being presumptuous, but ever since I heard of your feat at Ichijoji, I've been convinced that you're a man I would like, and like very much."
"Were you in Kyoto then?"
"Yes, I arrived during the first month of the year and was staying at Lord Date's residence on Sanjo Avenue. When I happened to drop in on Lord Karasumaru Mitsuhiro the day after the fight, I heard quite a bit about you. He said he'd met you and remarked on your youth and what you'd been doing in the past. Feeling this strong attraction, I resolved that I must make an effort to meet you. On my way from Kyoto, I saw the sign you put up at Shiojiri Pass."
"Oh, you saw that?" "Ironic," thought Musashi, that instead of bringing him Jotaro, The sign had brought him someone of whose existence he had never dreamed. But the more he considered the matter, the less he felt he deserved the esteem in which Geki seemed to hold him. Painfully conscious of his own mistakes and failures, he found Geki's adulation embarrassing. With perfect honesty, he said, "I think you're rating me too highly. There are a number of outstanding samurai serving under Lord Date. His fief has an income of 5 million bushels, you know. And in time, I've met many a skilled swordsman. But from what I've heard, it would seem that few can be compared with you. What's more, you're still very young. You have your whole future before you. And that, I suppose, is why you appeal to me. Anyway, now that I've found you, let's be friends. Have a drink, and talk about anything that interests you."
Musashi accepted the sake cup in good humor and began matching his host drink for drink. Before long, his face was bright red. Geki, still going strong, said,
"We samurai from the north can drink a lot. We do it to stay warm. Lord Date can outdrink any of us. With a strong general in the lead, it wouldn't do for the troops to fall behind."
The maid kept bringing more sake. Even after she'd trimmed the lamp wick several times, Geki showed no inclination to stop.
"Let's drink all night," he suggested. "That way we can talk all night."
"Fine," agreed Musashi. Then, with a smile, "You said you'd talk to Lord Karasumaru. Do you know him well?"
"You couldn't say we're close friends, but over the years I've been to his house any number of times on errands. He's very friendly, you know."
"Yes, I met him on the introduction of Honami Koetsu. For a nobleman, he seemed remarkably full of life."
Looking somewhat dissatisfied, Geki asked,
"Is that your only impression? If you'd talked with him at any length, I'd think you'd have been struck by his intelligence and sincerity."
"Well, we were in the licensed quarter at the time."
"In that case, I suppose he refrained from revealing his true self."
"What's he really like?"
Geki settled himself in more formal fashion and in a rather grave tone said,
"He's a troubled man. A man of sorrows, if you will. The shogunate's dictatorial ways disturb him greatly."
For a moment, Musashi was conscious of a lilting sound coming from the lake and the shadows cast by the white light of the lamp.
Abruptly, Geki said, "Musashi, my friend, for whose sake are you trying to perfect your swordsmanship?"
Never having considered the question, Musashi replied with guileless candor, "For my own."
"That's all right as far as it goes, but for whose sake are you trying to improve yourself? Surely your aim is not merely personal honor and glory. That's hardly sufficient for a man of your stature."
By accident or design, Geki had come around to the subject he really wanted to talk about.
"Now that the whole country is under Ieyasu's control," he declared, "we have a semblance of peace and prosperity. But is it real? Can the people actually live happily under the present system? Over the centuries, we've had the Hojos, the Ashikagas, Oda Nobunaga, Hideyoshi, a long string of military rulers consistently oppressing not only the people, but the emperor and the court as well. The imperial government has been taken advantage of, and the people mercilessly exploited. All the benefits have gone to the military class. This has been going on since Minamoto no Yoritomo, hasn't it? And the situation today is unchanged. Nobunaga seems to have had some idea of the injustice involved. At least he built a new palace for the emperor. Hideyoshi not only honored the emperor Go-Yosei by requiring all the daimyo to pay obeisance to him, but even tried to provide a measure of welfare and happiness for the common people. But what of Ieyasu? To all intents and purposes, he has no interest beyond the fortunes of his own clan. So again, the happiness of the people and the well-being of the imperial family are being sacrificed to create wealth and power for a military dictatorship. We seem to be at the threshold of another age of tyranny. No one worries about this state of affairs more than Lord Date Masamune, or, among the nobility, Lord Karasumaru."
Geki paused, waiting for a response, but none was forthcoming except for a barely articulate, "I see." Like anyone else, Musashi was aware of the drastic political changes that had occurred since the Battle of Sekigahara. Yet he had never paid any attention to activities of the daimyo in the Osaka faction, or the ulterior motives of the Tokugawas, or the stands taken by powerful outside lords like Date and Shimazu. All he knew about Date was that his fief, officially, had an income of 3 million bushels per year, but in fact probably yielded 5 million, as Geki had mentioned.
"Twice every year," Geki went on, "Lord Date sends produce from our fief to Lord Konoe in Kyoto for presentation to the emperor. He's never failed to do this, even in times of war. That's why I was in Kyoto. Aoba Castle is the only one in the country to have a special room reserved for the emperor. It's unlikely, of course, that it'll ever be used, but Lord Date set it aside for him anyway. Built it out of wood taken from the old imperial palace when that was rebuilt. He had the wood brought from Kyoto to Sendai by boat. And let me tell you about the war in Korea. During the campaigns there, Kato, Konishi, and other generals were competing for personal fame and triumph. Not Lord Date. Instead of his own family crest, he wore the crest of the rising sun and told everyone he'd never have led his men to Korea for the glory of his own clan or for that of Hideyoshi. He went out of love for Japan itself."
While Musashi listened attentively, Geki became absorbed in his monologue, describing his master in glowing terms and assuring Musashi that he was unexcelled in his single-minded devotion to the nation and the emperor. For a time, he forgot about drinking, but then suddenly looked down and said,
"The sake is cold."
Clapping his hands for the maid, he was about to order more. Musashi hurriedly interrupted,
"I've had more than enough. If you don't mind, I'd rather have some rice and tea now."
"Already?"
mumbled Geki. He was obviously disappointed, but, out of deference to his guest, told the girl to bring the rice. Geki continued to talk as they ate. The impression Musashi formed of the spirit that seemed to prevail among the samurai of Lord Date's fief was that, as individuals and as a group, they were vitally concerned with the way of the samurai and with the problem of disciplining themselves in accordance with the way. This way had existed since ancient times, when the warrior class had come into being, but its moral values and obligations were now little more than a vague memory. During the chaotic domestic strife of the 15th and 16th centuries, the ethics of the military man had been distorted, if not totally ignored, and now almost anyone who could wield a sword or shoot an arrow from a bow was regarded as a samurai, regardless of the attention, or lack of it, given to the deeper meaning of the way. The self-styled samurai of the day were often men of lower character and baser instincts than common peasants or townsmen. Having nothing but brawn and technique to command the respect of those beneath them, they were in the long run doomed to destruction. There were few daimyo capable of seeing this, and only a handful of the higher vassals of the Tokugawas and the Toyotomis gave any thought to establishing a new way of the samurai, which could become the foundation of the nation's strength and prosperity. Musashi's thoughts returned to the years when he had been confined in Himeji Castle. Takuan, remembering that Lord Ikeda had in his library a handwritten copy of Nichiyo Shushinkan by Fushikiyan, had taken it out for Musashi to study. Fushikiyan was the literary name of the celebrated general Uesugi Kenshin. In his book, he recorded points of daily ethical training for the guidance of his chief vassals. From this, Musashi had not only learned about Kenshin's personal activities, but also gained an understanding of why Kenshin's fief in Echigo had come to be known throughout the country for its wealth and military prowess. Swayed by Geki's enthusiastic descriptions, he began to feel that Lord Date, besides equaling Kenshin in integrity, had created in his domain an atmosphere in which samurai were encouraged to develop a new way, one that would enable them to resist even the shogunate, should that become necessary.
"You must forgive me for going on and on about matters of personal interest," said Geki. "What do you think, Musashi? Wouldn't you like to come to Sendai, see for yourself? His lordship is honest and straightforward. If you're striving to find the way, your present status doesn't matter to him. You can talk with him as you would with any other man. There's a great need for samurai who will devote their lives to their country. I'll be more than happy to recommend you. If it's all right with you, we can go to Sendai together."
By this time, the dinner trays had been removed, but Geki's ardor was in no way diminished. Impressed, but still cautious, Musashi replied, "I'll have to give it some thought before I can reply." After they had said goodnight, Musashi went to his room, where he lay awake in the dark, his eyes glistening. The way of the samurai. He concentrated on this concept as it applied to himself and to his sword. Suddenly he saw the truth. The techniques of a swordsman were not his goal. He sought an all-embracing way of the sword. The sword was to be far more than a simple weapon. It had to be an answer to life's questions. The way of Uesugi Kenshin and Date Masamune was too narrowly military, too hidebound. It would be up to him to add to its human aspect, to give it greater profundity, greater loftiness. For the first time, he asked whether it was possible for an insignificant human being to become one with the universe. A Gift of Money. Musashi's first waking thought was of Otsu and Jotaro, and though he and Geki carried on a convivial conversation over breakfast, the problem of how to find them was very much on his mind. After emerging from the inn, he unconsciously scrutinized every face he encountered on the high road. Once or twice, he thought he saw Otsu ahead, only to find he was mistaken.
"You seem to be looking for someone," said Geki.
"I am. My companions and I got separated along the way, and I'm worried about them. I think I'd better give up the idea of going to Edo with you and search some of the other roads." Disappointed, Geki said,
"That's too bad. I was looking forward to traveling with you. I hope the fact that I talked too much last night won't change your mind about visiting Sendai."
Geki's manner, straightforward and masculine, appealed to Musashi.
"That's very kind of you," he said. "I hope I have the chance someday."
"I want you to see for yourself how our samurai conduct themselves. And if you're not interested in that, then just regard it as a sightseeing trip. You can listen to the local songs and visit Matsushima. It's famous for its scenery, you know."
Geki took his leave and headed briskly for Wada Pass. Musashi turned around and went back to where the Koshu High Road branched off from the Nakasendo. As he stood there mapping out his strategy, a group of day laborers from Sua came up to him. Their dress suggested they were porters or grooms, or bearers of the primitive palanquins used in these parts. They approached slowly, arms folded, looking like an army of crabs. As their eyes rudely sized him up, one of them said,
"Sir, you seem to be looking for someone. A beautiful lady, is it? Or only a servant?"
Musashi shook his head, waved them off with a slightly disdainful gesture, and turned away. He did not know whether to go east or west, but finally made up his mind to spend the day seeing what he could find out in the neighborhood. If his inquiries led nowhere, he could then proceed to the shogun's capital with a clear conscience. One of the laborers broke in upon his thoughts.
"If you're looking for somebody, we could help you," he said. "It's better than standing around under the hot sun.
What does your friend look like?
Another added,
We won't even set a rate for our services. We'll leave it up to you.
Musashi relented to the extent of describing Otsu and Jotaro in detail. After consulting with his fellows, the first man said,
We haven't seen them, but if we split up, we're sure to find them. The kidnappers must have taken one of the three roads between Suwa and Shiojiri. You don't know this area, but we do.
None too optimistic about his chances of success in such difficult terrain, Musashi said,
All right, go look for them.
Done!
Shouted the men. Again they huddled, ostensibly deciding who was to go where. Then the ringleader came forward, rubbing his hands together deferentially.
There's just one little thing, sir. You see, I don't like to mention it, but we're just penniless laborers. Why, not one of us has had anything to eat yet today. Wonder if you couldn't advance us half a day's pay and say a little something extra? I guarantee we'll find your companions before sundown.
Of course. I was planning to give you something.
The man named a figure, which Musashi found, after counting his money, was more than he had. He was not unmindful of the value of money, but being alone, with no one to support, his attitude was on the whole indifferent. Friends and admirers sometimes donated travel funds, and there were temples where he could often obtain free lodging. At other times, he slept in the open or went without ordinary food. One way or another, he had always managed to get by. On this trip, he had left the finances to Otsu, who had received a sizable gift of travel money from Lord Karasumaru. She had been paying the bills and giving him a certain amount of spending money each morning, as any ordinary housewife might do. Keeping only a little for himself, he distributed the rest of his money among the men, and though they'd expected more, they agreed to undertake the search as a special favor.
"Wait for us by the two-story gate of the Suwa Myojin Shrine," the spokesman advised. "By evening we'll be back with some news."
They made off in several directions. Rather than waste the day doing nothing, Musashi went to see Takashima Castle and the town of Shimosuwa, stopping here and there to note features of the local topography which might come in handy at some future date, and to observe the methods of irrigation. He asked several times whether there were any outstanding military experts in the area, but heard nothing of interest. As sundown drew near, he went to the shrine and sat down, tired and dispirited, on the stone stairway leading up to the two-story gate. No one showed up, so he took a turn around the spacious shrine grounds. But when he returned to the gate, there was still no one there. Though not loud, the sound of horses stamping the ground began to get on his nerves. Descending the steps, he came upon a shed, obscured by the trees, where an ancient horsekeeper was feeding the shrine's sacred white horse. He glanced at Musashi accusingly.
"Can I help you?"
he asked brusquely.
"Do you have some business with the shrine?"
Upon hearing why Musashi was there, he broke out in uncontrollable laughter. Musashi, seeing nothing at all funny about his predicament, made no attempt to conceal a scowl. Before he spoke, however, the old man said,
"You've no business being on the road by yourself. You're too innocent. Did you really believe roadside vermin would spend the whole day looking for your friends? If you paid them in advance, you'll never see them again."
"You mean you think they were just putting on an act when they divided up and left?"
The horsekeeper's expression changed to one of sympathy.
"You've been robbed," he said. "I heard there were about 10 vagrants drinking and gambling in the grove on the other side of the mountain all day today. They're most likely the ones."
"These things happen all the time."
He went on to tell some stories of travelers being cheated out of their money by unscrupulous laborers, but concluded mildly,
"That's the way the world is. You'd better be more careful from now on."
With this sage advice, he picked up his empty pail and departed, leaving Musashi feeling foolish.
"It's too late to do anything now," he sighed. "I pride myself on my ability not to give my opponent any opening,
and then get taken in by a gang of illiterate workmen. This evidence of his gullibility came like a slap in the face. Such lapses could easily muddy his practice of the art of war. How could a man so easily deceived by his inferiors effectively command an army? As he climbed slowly toward the gate, he resolved to henceforth pay more attention to the ways of the world about him. One of the laborers was peering around in the dark, and as soon as he caught sight of Musashi, he called to him and ran partway down the steps.
"Glad I found you, sir," he said. "I've got news about one of the people you're looking for."
"Oh?" Musashi, having just reprimanded himself for his naivete, was astonished but gratified to know that not everyone in the world was a swindler. "By one of them, do you mean the boy or the woman?"
"The boy. He's with Daizo of Narai, and I found out where Daizo is, or at least where he's headed."
"Where might that be?"
"I didn't think that bunch I was with this morning would do what they promised. They took the day off to gamble, but I felt sorry for you. I went from Shiojiri to Seba, asking everybody I ran into. Nobody knew anything about the girl, but I heard from the maid at the inn where I ate that Daizo passed through Sua about noon today on his way to Wada Pass. She said he had a young boy with him."
Embarrassed, Musashi said rather formally, "It was good of you to let me know." He took out his money pouch, knowing it contained only enough for his own meal. He hesitated a moment, but reflecting that honesty should not go unrewarded, gave the laborer his last bit of cash. Pleased with the tip, the man raised the money to his forehead in a gesture of thanks and went happily on his way. Watching his money go down the road, Musashi felt he had used it for a purpose worthier than that of filling his stomach. Perhaps the laborer, having learned that right conduct can be profitable, would go out on the road the next day and help another traveler. It was already dark, but he decided that instead of sleeping under the eaves of some peasant's house, he would cross Wada Pass. By traveling all night, he should be able to catch up with Daizo. He started off, savoring once again the satisfaction of being on a deserted road at night. Something about it appealed to his nature. Counting his footsteps, listening to the silent voice of the heavens above, he could forget everything and rejoice in his own being. When he was surrounded by crowds of busy people, his spirit often seemed sad and isolated, but now he felt alive and buoyant. He could think about life coolly and objectively, even appraise himself as he might appraise a total stranger. A little after midnight, his musings were distracted by a light in the distance. He had been climbing steadily since crossing the bridge over the Ochiai River. One pass was behind him. The next one, at Wada, loomed up in the starry sky ahead, and beyond that, the even higher crossing at Daimon. The light was in a hollow that ran parallel to the two ridges. "It looks like a bonfire," he thought, feeling pangs of hunger for the first time in hours. "Maybe they'll let me dry off my sleeves, give me a bit of gruel or something." As he drew near, he saw that it wasn't an outdoor fire, but the light from a small roadside tea house. There were four or five stakes for tying horses, but no horses. It seemed incredible that there would be anyone in such a place at this hour, yet he could hear the sound of raucous voices mingling with the crackling of the fire. He stood hesitantly under the eaves for a few minutes. If it had been a farmer's or a woodcutter's hut, he would have had no qualms about asking for shelter and some leftovers, but this was a place of business. The smell of food made him hungrier than ever. The warm smoke enveloped him. He could not tear himself away. "Well, if I explain my situation to them, maybe they'll accept the statue as payment." The statue was the small image of Kannon he had carved from the wood of an ancient plum tree. When he barged into the shop, the startled customers stopped talking. The interior was simple, a dirt floor with a hearth and a fire hood in the middle, around which huddled three men on stools. Stewing in a pot was a mixture of boar's meat and giant radish. A jar of sake was warming in the ashes. Standing with his back to them, slicing pickles and chatting good-naturedly, was the proprietor.
"What do you want?"
asked one of the customers, a keen-eyed man with long sideburns. Too hungry to hear, Musashi passed by the men and, seating himself on the edge of a stool, said to the proprietor,
"Give me something to eat, quick! Rice and pickles will do, anything!"
The man poured some of the stew over a bowl of cold rice and set it before him.
"Are you planning to cross the pass tonight?"
he asked.
Mumbled
Musashi, who had already seized some chopsticks and was attacking the food with gusto. After his second mouthful, he asked,
"Do you know if a man named Daizo, he comes from Narai, passed here this afternoon, going toward the pass? He has a young boy with him."
"I'm afraid I can't help you."
Then to the other men,
"Toji, did you or your friends see an older man traveling with a boy?"
After a bit of whispering, the three replied in the negative, shaking their heads in unison. Musashi, filled and warmed by the hot food, began to worry about the bill. He'd hesitated discussing it with the proprietor first, due to the presence of the other men, but he didn't for a moment feel he was begging. It had simply seemed more important to tend to his stomach's needs first. He made up his mind that if the shopkeeper would not accept the statue, he'd offer him his dagger.
"I'm sorry to have to tell you this," he began, "but I don't have any cash at all. I'm not asking for a free meal, mind you. I have something here to offer in payment, if you'll take it."
With unexpected amiability, the proprietor replied,
"I'm sure that'll be all right. What is it?"
"A statue of Kannon."
"A real statue?"
"Oh, it's not the work of a famous sculptor, just something I carved myself. It may not be worth even the price of a bowl of rice, but take a look at it anyway." As he began untying the cords of his bag, the one he had carried for years, the three men left off drinking and focused their attention on his hands. Besides the statue, the bag contained a single change of underwear and a writing set. When he emptied out the contents, something fell with a clunk to the ground. The others gasped, for the object that lay at Musashi's feet was a money pouch, from which several gold and silver coins had spilled out. Musashi himself stared in speechless amazement.
"Where did that come from?" he wondered.
The other men craned their necks to gape at the treasure. Feeling something else in the bag, Musashi pulled out a letter. It consisted of a single line saying,
"This should take care of your travel expenses for the time being," and was signed Giki.
Musashi had a pretty clear idea of what it meant. It was Geki's way of trying to buy his services for Lord Date Masamune of Sendai and Aoba Castle. The increasing probability of a final clash between the Tokugawas and the Toyotomis made it imperative for the great daimyo to maintain sizable numbers of able fighters. A favorite method used in the cutthroat competition for the few really outstanding samurai was to attempt to get such men in debt, even for a small sum, and then forge a tacit agreement for future cooperation. It was common knowledge that Toyotomi Hideyori was providing large sums of money to Goto Matabe and Sanada Yukimura. Though Yukimura was ostensibly in retirement on Mount Kudo, so much gold and silver was being sent to him from Osaka Castle that Ieyasu had undertaken a full-scale investigation. Since the personal requirements of a retired general living in hermitage were fairly modest, it was all but certain that the money was being passed on to several thousand indigent ronin who were idling away their time in nearby towns and cities, waiting for the outbreak of hostilities. Finding an able warrior, as Geki believed he had, and somehow enticing him into his lord's service was one of the most valuable services a retainer could perform. And it was for just this reason that Musashi had no interest in Geki's money. Using it would incur an unwanted obligation. In a matter of seconds, he decided to ignore the gift to pretend it did not exist. Without a word, he reached down, picked up the pouch, and restored it to his bag. Addressing the proprietor as though nothing had happened, he said,
"All right, then.
I'll leave the statue here in payment. But the man balked.
I can't accept that now, sir.
Is there something wrong with it? I don't claim to be a sculptor.